All right, we are in Jeremiah chapter 12. And by the way, also, most of you, I think all of you, probably been coming here long enough. We're covering the material we're covering in part because of requests. But there's been a lot of prophetic material and stuff like this, but we're not hearing a lot of good, positive, uplifting things along the way here. And Jeremiah in particular is, and he didn't like his message. Jeremiah didn't like preaching this stuff. He tried to stop doing it at one point, and God wouldn't let him. So I know it's not always easy to sit here and just, doesn't he have anything positive to say? We will get there. There are some positive things here in Jeremiah, some absolutely amazing things, because there's something in Jeremiah that is extremely relevant to us today. And that will be, it's a few weeks down the road, but we'll get there. I'm not familiar enough with Jeremiah to do an ad lib and do a survey of the book. There are books I could do that with, but Jeremiah is not one of them. We are in chapter 12. Oh, I forgot to make a change in your outlines. I miswrote something. The top line, promise of punishment, should be punishment and promise. Punishment and promise. My wife's laughing at me because I noted that when I was doing some commentary reading this afternoon, and I thought, oh, I'll have to change that, and then I didn't change it. Punishment and promise. Yes. Our new webmaster. All right. At the beginning here, Jeremiah asks a question that is asked repeatedly in the Old Testament. And Job deals with this at length. Psalm 37, Psalm 73, the book of Habakkuk, all deal with this this same theme. And that is the prosperity of the wicked. Why is it that sometimes the righteous suffer, very often, as a matter of fact, the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? And let's get into the text, and then we're going to consider some implications of this. It says, righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee. So he's going to acknowledge that God is God, that God is righteous. That's a given. Yet let me talk with thee. He's going to do the same thing that the psalmist does, that Habakkuk does, and that Job does. He wants to graciously argue with God. And God, I know you're righteous. I know you're righteous. Yet let me talk with you of thy judgments. I think that there's something amiss here. And wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Why does this happen? Wherefore are all they happy that deal very treacherously? They seem to be having a grand time. We see that in our own day. That all these extremely wicked people, it seems, as a matter of fact, that the purveyors of wickedness are extremely wealthy. And at least outwardly, and I'll guarantee you that most of it is outward, are exhibiting all kinds of happiness and joy, and life is one giant party, and the enthusiasm and the fun never ends. And of course, that's a facade, but still, that's the perception that we get. Verse 2. Thou hast planted them. They have taken root. They grow. Yea, they bring forth fruit. Thou art near in their mouth, but far from their reins, like our politicians all the way back always like to cite God. And I get a kick out of the last 15, 20 years. The people who are in high office are so unfamiliar with the Scripture, they can't even get it right. They'll misquote it, or they'll attribute something to the Bible that isn't in the Bible. because they don't know the Bible at all, and they don't bother. I mean, with computers, you'd think they could double-check this stuff, but they don't. But God is always on their lips, but far from their reins. And reins is kidneys. You have your renal system, for those of you who are into biology stuff. Understand that the seat of emotions, the seat of affections and stuff, we think of as the heart. Now, we know this is just a muscle that pumps the blood around you. But we still refer to your heart. The ancients referred to the heart, the kidneys, the viscera, but the kidneys and the heart in particular. And you will see the word reins in your King James Version fairly often. It's just an old word for kidneys. And the King James is one of the few versions that actually translates it kidneys. Newer translations will throw the heart in there because that's the intent, the idea in Western understanding. But the word is kidneys. So, but God is far from their heart. God is far from their affections. He's right on their lips. So you have the prosperity of the wicked. They say one thing, live another. Nothing's changed. We see this all the time. But thou, O Lord, you know me. Thou hast seen me and tried mine heart toward thee. Pull, and so we have an imprecatory prayer from Jeremiah. We don't see a lot of these with Jeremiah. And, in fact, if you and I were in Jeremiah's place, dare I say that we would be throwing these out a lot more frequently than he did. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long shall the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither by the wickedness of them that consume them? The beasts are consumed and the birds because they have said, he shall not see our last end. God isn't paying attention. I can do as I please. I can take advantage of the circumstances, and I and God will never know. Now that's the mentality of the wicked, and that's Jeremiah's complaint. Now why? And by the way, we don't see this same thing in the New Testament. Why is it that in the Old Testament, Job, the psalmist, one of them by Asaph, one by David. We see this in Habakkuk, we see this in Jeremiah, and by the way, it's sprinkled through a lot of other places as well. We see this in Proverbs. They had this dilemma. We see the prosperity of the wicked. God, why is this? And why is it that the Old Testament saints struggled with this more than we do today? Or, let me change that, more than New Testament saints did. Why is that? We start out with God being righteous. Now, let's look at some other attributes of God. We know that God is just, and that's the one that they're struggling with. God is just. We know that God is just. And yet we see the wicked prospering, and we see the righteous suffer. And that's hard to reconcile with God being just, unless you consider something. Think hard. Do you find much discussion about the resurrection or the afterlife in the Old Testament? I've got a message in my files that I preached before on the resurrection in the Old Testament. And in one sermon, I cover all the texts that deal with it. I believe there's basically four or five of them. And none of them go into a great deal of detail. There's a concept called progressive revelation, that as time has gone by, God gives people more and more information. I mean, what did Adam and Eve know that at least we have recorded? They knew very little as far as what God's plan was and what God was going to do. I believe that the basic understanding of trusting God for salvation was there from the beginning. I believe that the idea of atonement was there at the beginning. And I believe that God is the one that instituted the sacrificial system by providing clothes of skins for Adam and Eve. I believe that he instituted that, and that there's some information that he gave Adam and Eve that is not out there in front, but the fact that they understood a sacrificial system, that Cain and Abel understood a sacrificial system, that God provided them with clothes of skins and allowed them to live for 900 years or more past this point, is an indication they understood the idea of atonement. And also in Genesis chapter 3, there is the idea of God's coming Redeemer. So they have but over time we get more and more information. There was a lot of information in the Abrahamic covenant. There's a bunch of stuff that was given through Moses. And as time goes by, chronologically, anybody here have a chronological Bible? What name? Reese. took the King James Version and basically cut and pasted it until he had the whole Bible arranged chronologically, which means that sometimes you only have one chapter of something, you know, and but you get a different flow because everything's in chronological order. And as you go through this, you find that, that it's especially noticeable in that format that things get, they find out things along the way. And even when we get to the New Testament, understand that Peter talks about this at length, that, that the prophets really wondered what they were prophesying. What does this mean? Daniel chapter 12, God gives Daniel all this revelation, and Daniel says, what's it mean? And he says to Daniel, you'll have to wait. And of course, we don't like to wait. I want to know now. I'm already an old man. I want to know. Well, then you will know then. In the Old Testament, the idea that in the afterlife, God would take care of everything wasn't in their thinking. They were just looking at the here and now, in the present life. If God is truly just, and we believe he is, that in the hereafter, everything will be taken care of. All the horribly wicked that seem to prosper, they will suffer accordingly. And the righteous who have suffered will gain. The idea of it will be worth it all when we see Jesus. All right, it definitely will be. It definitely will be. We get that in the Scriptures. That's taught in the Scriptures. But Jeremiah didn't have that information, at least not a lot of it. And so he struggles with what he's seeing compared with what he knows of God. And God doesn't give him a lot of comfort in this. There's a verse here that's very familiar. He says in verse 5, this is God's answer to Jeremiah. Verses 5 and 7 are God's answer to Jeremiah. If thou hast run with the footmen, infantry, and they have wearied thee, how canst thou contend with the cavalry? It's going to get worse, Jeremiah. You think it's bad now. It's going to get worse. He doesn't answer Jeremiah's question, by the way. He doesn't answer Jeremiah's question here. If in the land of peace wherein thou trustest they have wearied thee, how wilt thou do in the swelling of Jordan? Every April, May, the springtime, it was harvest time in Israel, the Jordan would overflow its banks and you had a big floodplain. And understand that Israel, climate-wise, especially at the lower elevations, is actually quite warm. It's tropical. They grow bananas and papayas and stuff like that up in the Galilee region. You see pictures of snow at Jerusalem. Jerusalem is like 3,000 feet in elevation, and the snow that they get, all the photographers rush out and take the pictures when it snows because it only happens like every 15, 20 years. It's a tropical place. Down along Jordan, you had a floodplain that went a mile or two on either side of the river. The River Jordan, even in ancient times, was not very big. About as wide as this room. It's not very big. But its headwaters are up at Mount Hermon. It gets snow in the wintertime. They run down in three main streams, feed the Sea of Galilee, and then the Sea of Galilee overflows and runs down the Jordan. And so in the springtime, when the snows on Hermon would melt, that's when you would have the flood further downstream. And it would flood and fill up this jungle that was along the shores of Jordan. Up until even Roman times, that jungle was filled with wild boar and lions and leopards and deer and all kinds of wildlife lived in there. And when the floods came, all the animals came out for the month or so. This is when you were going to lose your lambs and stuff. Lions and leopards and stuff are looking for something to eat. And then when the waters went down, they went back down in there because there's cover and there's prey and stuff like that. But it was an annual thing. So it was the flooding of Jordan created a problem for those who lived fairly close by. He says, if you can't handle the footmen, the infantry, how are you going to handle the cavalry? If you can't handle when the land is at peace and they've wearied thee, how can you handle when the Jordan is flooding and you've got all these wild animals running around? How can you handle that? He still doesn't answer the question. He's saying, suck it up. All right. I'll sustain, because God had promised before, I'll sustain you. And that's what God has promised us now. He will sustain us. He will give us what we need to do what we need to do. But to make everything okay in the here and now is not part of God's promise. God will do that, but there's no promise that he will do that now. And so he doesn't answer the question. But he does go on to say, starting in verse 7, that the wicked will be punished. Now, in Jeremiah's day, the wicked were punished in the here and now. We have, Ecclesiastes talks about this, that you have the wicked who grow old and die surrounded by family, lots of children, and then you have some righteous fellow that suffers in great poverty and in great pain, his children taken away from him. God will deal with all of this in the hereafter and more than make up for it. So judgment beginning in verse 7, punishment of the ungodly. The setting for this is probably 2 Kings chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. You have several kings. Remember, you start out in Jeremiah's prophecy, you start out at the beginning with a guy named Josiah. Good King Josiah. Josiah's father and grandfather were two of the most horrible kings that Judah ever had. This guy comes on the scene, he's a young man, and determines that he's going to serve the Lord, and he's going to do what he can with the time allotted to him. And even he receives a prophecy that Jerusalem is eventually going to be destroyed, that there's nothing he can do, it's irreparable at this point. He says, while I'm here, we will do what is right. And Josiah dies at the age of 39. He is succeeded by a guy. Let me see if I can remember these. Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim is a young guy. He's 18 years old. By the way, when you read about the queen, this will come up later on. When you read about the queen, it's not his wife. The queen was almost never the wife of the king because they were polygamous. They had 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 24, 72, 300 wives, 600 porcupines, this huge number of wives. And you see all the difficulties that they had in Persia trying to pick one to be the queen. And if she didn't work out, well, we just have to go back to the drawing board. So they didn't do that in Israel and Judah. The queen mother was the queen. And she was also an advisor to the king, and especially when he was young, had a huge amount of influence on him. So you have Jehoiakim. Now, Jehoiakim was 18 years old, and he was a rascal. His mother influenced him. You had a deportation that happened. He didn't reign very long. They had a deportation that followed on this, that Nebuchadnezzar came and he was deported. And so that's the setting for this thing. He is rebelling against Nebuchadnezzar. An agreement had been made, a covenant had been made, and he breaks that covenant. Judah and Israel did this too, but Judah especially. In the Middle East, you can't think of it as a big swath of ground like this. You have to think of it as an avenue that happens to have a curve to it. Because all the population, all the nations were on this curve that was at best only 200-300 miles wide. And on the ends of this long avenue is where you had the power at this time. You got Babylon over here, and you've got Egypt over here. Well, if Egypt's over here, and Babylon is trying to gobble up more and more territory to pin Egypt into there, what's the last place he's coming to before he gets down into Egypt as far as a kingdom is concerned? Judah. Judah was at the crossroads. Judah was the last place. And because of their location, and you couldn't really get around Judah without going into either very narrow places or very inhospitable places. You'd go along the coast, and that was the Philistine territory, but Judah by this time, the Philistines were pretty weak at this time, and Judah influenced a lot of authority in that area. And if you went farther to the east and to the south, that's pretty harsh desert area. So Judah was at the crossroads. And Judah, because they were at the crossroads, did a lot of diplomatic work because they weren't very big. And they would try to become buddies with the Egyptians, which never, ever, ever worked out. They kept doing it over and over again, but it never was. During their entire history, it was never to their advantage. I never did figure that one out. They didn't either. So they're trying to chum up to the Egyptians. But we can't leave the Babylonians out or the Assyrians out earlier on. So we just won't tell the Egyptians that we're going to be buddying up over here too. And so we're going to try to play them against each other so that we can continue being where we are, doing what we do. It's kind of like being, I suppose, the Belgians between the French and the Germans during the World Wars. You know, you're between a rock and a hard place, and you make the most of your circumstance. So this is the setting there as well. All right, so the judgment beginning at verse seven. I have forsaken mine house, mine inheritance. I have left mine heritage. I have given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. This is God speaking. Mine heritage is unto me as a lion in the forest. It crieth out unto me. Therefore have I hated it. Mine heritage, in other words, it's yelling for me, but it seeks to do me violence or to go against me. Mine heritage is unto me as a speckled bird. The birds around about are against her. Come ye, assemble all beasts of the field, come to devour. The speckled bird is not a sparrow. A speckled bird is a hawk, like the ones you see sitting on light poles going down 167. See those little red-tailed hawks? They have birds almost exactly like that in Israel. And so over there they call them buzzards. Here buzzards are turkey vultures, but over there buzzards are hawks. And so they have that speckled, you've seen them. You know what I'm talking about? Okay. So they're a speckled bird. Now if they're sitting out in the open, especially if they're sitting down low, what happens over a period of time? Around here it's crows. A lot of places though I have seen a bunch of robins or smaller birds begin to gather around this thing because they know it really can't hurt them, but they're going to pick on it, and they'll go after it. I've seen, just like you see a flock of crows going after a bald eagle or an owl or a hawk. By the way, somebody told me the other day they were watching a bald eagle, and he was being dealt with a big flock of hawks, and he did a barrel roll and got one. But that doesn't happen too often. But you got a bunch of birds around this supposedly formidable bird, but they're all picking on him. And that's how he pictures Judah here. But the idea here is that they will devour. They will overcome. Verse 10, many pastors have destroyed my vineyard, have trodden down my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. Normally a pastor would be the kings, the leadership of the country. In this context, and the commentators think this, but the commentators will tell you that this is the leadership of the invading armies. Even if it's not, the leadership in-house has hurt the nation. So many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion desolate wilderness, which ties in with what we saw in verse 4. They have made it desolate, and being desolate, it mourneth unto me. The whole land is made desolate because no man layeth it to heart. They're not learning the lesson. There's drought, there's difficulty going on, and the people are not paying attention. They will not heed the warning. They have sown wheat, but shall reap thorns. They have put themselves to pain, but shall not profit. And they shall be ashamed of your revenues because of the fierce anger of the Lord. And yet we have something very odd, because he's dealing with invasion and oppression from outside. But we have something that has not taken place historically, but must be, and therefore must be future, if it's a promise and it's a declaration. Look at verse 14. Thus saith the Lord against all mine evil neighbors. Some of you may think that about people who live around you. For Israel, who were the wicked neighbors? Well, to the east you had the Ammonites. To the southeast you had Moab. To the south-southeast you had Edom. To the southwest and west you had the Philistines. And to the north it was now basically sort of a no-man's land because Israel had been yanked out of there. But they have enemies around them. Further to north you had Syria. You had a number of, and then Egyptians to the southwest. You never know what they're going to do. They'd invaded a number of times. So they don't have friendly people around them. And they're wicked people. They're idolaters. They're involved in all kinds of wickedness and debauchery. You go through the opening chapters of Amos, and he goes through each of these nations and talks about the characteristics that will bring them the judgment. And so the evil neighbors that touch the inheritance which they have caused my people Israel to inherit, behold, I will pluck them out of the land and pluck up the house of Judah from among them. All of them, all those nations that I just described, they're going to be pulled out of the land. Who's going to do that? Nebuchadnezzar is going to do that. He isn't necessarily going to take absolutely everybody, just like he didn't take absolutely all of Judah. But the ones that are left are the poorest of the poor, and just to keep the land from reverting back to wilderness, there's enough people there to maintain some olive groves and do some crops and so on, just to keep the land from reverting back to wilderness. But there was no government there. There was no cities or anything. It was a few scattered, wall-less villages, and that was it. The land was vacated of its people. I will pluck them out. I will return and have compassion on them, and will bring them again, every man into his heritage and every man into his land. So each of those nations is going to come back. Now, to some extent, historically, that happened. To some extent. Understand that very few peoples go extinct. They get assimilated. The descendants of all these folks are still with us today. It's just they're not a recognized separate ethnic group. They've been absorbed by somebody else. I will bring them back, every man into his heritage, verse 16, and it shall come to pass if, so we have a contingency here, if they will diligently learn the ways of my people, of repentant Judah, to swear by my name, the Lord liveth. And by the way, this was not just an oath. But if they recognized that the Lord liveth, that meant that they were recognizing that the Lord is God. They were embracing the God of Israel as their God. As they taught my people to swear by Baal, the false teachers coming from without, then shall they be built into the midst of my people. But if they will not obey, I will utterly pluck them out and destroy that nation, saith the Lord. It's almost like what God is promising here is when they return, if they will embrace the truth that God has revealed to Israel and embrace Israel's God, then he's making the same promise to them that he made to Israel as far as the Palestinian covenant, the aspect of the Mosaic covenant. The land's yours. If you obey, you can stay there. If you'll embrace me, you can stay in this land. What's very interesting is you go through end time prophecies and you will find that a lot of these nations will be there in the millennium. The Ammonites will be there during the millennium. Edom will be there during the millennium. A lot of these nations will be there during the millennium, which indicates that they actually will embrace the God of Israel. One of the things that's interesting is from after the time of Nebuchadnezzar, Moab ceases to be a people. They're not extinct, but God knows who the descendants of the Moabites are, and they'll be back in the land. During Roman times, by the time we get to the Roman times, the Ammonites were not an independent people, but their descendants are still with us. By 2nd, 3rd century, the Edomites couldn't be identified as a separate people, and yet their descendants are still there. And the same thing's true with the Philistines and all these other folks that are around them. God knows who they are. He will bring them back in. He will sort them out and have them in the right place doing the right thing. But this is a contingency, but from what we see in other passages, the indication is that during the millennium, this will be fulfilled. So even those rascals all around Israel will be in their own allotted pieces of ground. And these are the nations also, for the most part, that God would not allow Israel under Moses to displace from the land. God said, I gave this piece of ground to the children of Ammon. I gave this piece of ground to the children of Moab. I gave this piece of ground to the children of Edom. So they have a promise from God as well. All right, chapter 13. And he uses a series of illustrations here, indicating the corruption of Israel's national life. The first one's kind of strange, and believe it or not, the first one has created all kinds, pages and pages and pages of discussion, which to me I think is kind of silly. It misses the point of the illustration. Majoring on minors. Thus saith the Lord, go and get thee a linen girdle. This would be a waistband. A waistband made of linen. It's not made out of leather. It's not made out of coarser material. It's made out of linen, which is made from the stalk of a plant. It's finer than cotton, all right. It's a plant-based fiber. The Egyptians made a lot of stuff out of linen. So go get yourself a linen girdle, a linen sash. It's going to go around your waist. Just like today, the guys, you know, you have the fancy necktie. I mean, the guys will spend an outrageous amount of money on a necktie. You don't pay attention to a suit, his shoes, anything else. You look at the necktie. The necktie is the thing that always changes. And back in this time, if you were dressed up in your finery, it was the sash that was the center point of your personal decorum. So go get one of these, and don't put it in water. Now, I don't know if... I would assume it's the same way at your house. You buy a new package of t-shirts or a new package of white socks, and they practically glow in the dark. And then when you wash them and then compare them to the one that's still in the package, it just doesn't look the same. It has lost some of that brightness. It got dirty being washed. Right?
You're using the wrong detergent, Pastor. We've tried Tide. It does the same thing. It doesn't matter how much bleach you use. You have to use those toxic chemicals they use at the sock-making plant.
All right. But he says, you want this thing to be clean. You want this thing to be pristine. And that's the idea there, that it's pristine. It's perfect. It's just brand new. So I got the girdle according to the word of the Lord and put it on my loins. I wore it. And the word of the Lord came unto me the second time, saying, take the girdle that you got, that's upon your loins, arise and go to Euphrates and hide it there in a hole in the rock. Now, believe it or not, the big debate is Jeremiah having to go to Euphrates, which is like a 700-mile round trip. Why would God send him on a 700-mile round trip to hide an article of clothing in a hole in the rock? Now, he's not necessarily going all the way to Babylon. Euphrates does, you know, this angle, so he would be going straight up north, the north side. Even today, the northern Syria, the country of Syria borders the Euphrates up at the top. So that's what the big debate is, which I think is kind of silly. If God wanted him to go there, he could take a few weeks and walk there and do the job and come back. So I went and hid it by Euphrates, as the Lord commanded me. I did what I was told to do. Long walk, but I did it. And it came to pass after many days, doesn't say how long, maybe it's been a year, a few months, who knows, probably a season, at least a year. He said, arise, go to Euphrates, you got to go back and take the girdle from thence, which I commanded thee. So you got to go back and retrieve what you hid there in the crevice in the rocks. Now, I'm thinking almost certainly you've had a whole year go by. You've had the different seasons, the cold, the warm, the dry, the wet. So then I went to Euphrates, verse 7, and I digged, crumbled, filled in the gap where he put this thing, and took the girdle from the place where I had hid it, and behold, the girdle was marred and profitable for nothing. You can imagine Jeremiah saying, so why did I do this? But it has a very good meaning. It's an object lesson. Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, thus saith the Lord,
After this manner will I mar the pride of Judah and the great pride of Jerusalem. This evil people, which refuse to hear my words, which walk in the imagination of their heart, and walk after other gods to serve them and to worship them, shall even be as this girdle, which is good for nothing. It started out pristine, it was beautiful, it was lovely, it was useful, and now it's good for nothing. For as the girdle cleaveth to the loins of a man, so have I caused to cleave unto me the whole house of Israel and the whole house of Judah, saith the Lord. And that they might be unto me for a people and for a name and for a praise. That God was going to use this people to accomplish something for his glory and for his honor. But they would not hear. They are good for nothing. They are not, the point is, they are not fulfilling their purpose because they can't. They have rendered themselves unusable. And they've done it to themselves, not just the passing of time, not just what happens, but they've done it to themselves. They would not hear. Second object lesson. Therefore, verse 12, thou shalt speak unto them this word, thus saith Lord God of Israel, every bottle shall be filled with wine. The idea there is not, don't think of what you see in the grocery store, the regular wine bottle. Think of, I'm going to digress here for a minute. I'm going to chase this for a little while. When I was in junior high, I was visiting some relatives, and my cousin had gone out and he picked a bunch of wild choke cherries, which are very puckery. They grow around here. They're called choke cherries because it's like hard to swallow. But he put them in a colander. He mashed them up in a bowl. Put them in a colander and put a cheesecloth down and pressed it and juiced them. And then he put the juice in a mason jar and sealed it up and set it in the sun. Now you tell me what happened. After a little while, his parents didn't know about this because it was behind the curtains. Here, guys, come and taste some of this. It's like keeping the cider behind the curtains. You know, it does the same thing. And found out the choke cherry was actually pretty good. If you like that kind of thing. But what the key was is you had to keep the lid on the jar. If you don't keep the lid on the jar, what happens? Well, not the mold, because number one, it would lose the fizziness to it. But what else? The alcohol would evaporate. The alcohol evaporates a lot easier than water does. If you rub some rubbing alcohol on a countertop or something like that, it's gone very quickly. So in order to have and maintain, you can have it for a short period of time, but in order to maintain a wine that has an alcohol content to it, it has to be in a sealed container. If you are fermenting juice or storing grape juice or any kind of juice in an open container, it will eventually either rot, evaporate, or turn into vinegar. In ancient times, the idea of having a bottle of alcohol wine, you had to hit... Did drunkenness occur in ancient times? Absolutely. But you had to time it. You had to have your wine processed in a certain way, and it was only good if you wanted the drunken effect for a certain window of its life because of the nature of how they stored their wine. They stored their wine in crocks. Some of these were up to 10 or 12 gallons. They stored them in crocks. The people in Moab were processors of wine. Now, you live in a climate, it's the Middle East, it's hot, it's dry, you're growing your grapes, and you want to be able to use them in the off-season. You want to be able to have the benefit of your crop in the off-season. Okay, raisins, all right. How am I going to preserve my wine? I don't want it to turn to vinegar. There was some of that. Remember, we saw vinegars used several times in the New Testament. That's what they put on the sponge to, all right. So they did use some of that. My dad stayed with his great aunt when he was a boy one time, and they made some fruit vinegars that he said were actually pretty palatable. It was sort of a backcountry kind of thing that they did. But for the most part, that was not the thing. What would they do? How did they preserve the crop? They didn't have to boil it. No. If you live in a place that's very similar to, Southern California, away from the coast, what they would do is they'd have these crocks and they'd have the tops open and would evaporate.
And they would take these things and they would pour them from one container to another to get the sediment out of these things. When it says that, one of the prophecies that says that Moab is settled on his lees. The lees is all the crud that settles to the bottom of the thing. They would pour this very carefully and then scrape out the crud and clean the thing out. And then they let this sit in this pot for a while and they pour it back and forth to get rid of the sediments that were in there. And over a period of time, as it's open, because it's a crock, it's you know, about yay high, about that big around at the top. It's got a lot of surface area. It evaporates. Now, when you have a concentrate that is becoming thicker and thicker, you are creating something that is preserved because of two things. Number one, you have to have water for the bacteria. Number two, the sugar content is rising high enough that stuff can't live in it. This is why you can keep a lot of things, Karo syrup or whatever, it's got water in it, but you can keep it in your cupboard. You don't have to refrigerate it. Because it's the sugar content keeps the bacteria from growing in it. I'm not saying that this is always the case, but most of your wine that was processed in the Middle East and was being processed for later consumption during the course of the year was stuff that had been dried, had been rendered into syrups that would be used, and that's one of the reasons they had to mix them with water, because who wants to drink the straight syrup? You would dilute it with water. And actually, they diluted it a lot more than we would. And that's what they did with their wine. So most of the time, it was not alcoholic. Sometimes it was. But most of the time, it was not. So that was your digression. But when they were doing the harvest, and when it was new wine, that's when it had alcohol in it. It doesn't take real long. I was at my dad's place. We picked a lot of elderberries at my dad's place one time. And I put them in a crock, and I mashed them all up. And within a week, it had a bite to it. We were not big wine producers, by the way, just letting you know. But it had a bite to it. So for those of you who are there this morning. So we kept pressing it, and then we poured it out, and we had it in a smaller container, but it didn't take real long before it turned to vinegar. And it lost that aspect of it. So it was following harvest that they would have some of these drunken things, because that was the window of time when that kind of wine was readily available. And that's what he's talking about here in verse 12. Therefore, thou shalt speak unto them this word. Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, every bottle shall be filled with wine, every crock shall be filled with wine. And they shall say unto them, do thee, and by the way, when it says filled with wine, the idea there is, if you see the word filled with wine in the Old Testament, this context is saying you're filling up a container. But if it talks about people being filled with wine, what does that mean? They're drunk. Okay? So he says, every bottle shall be filled with wine, and they shall say unto thee, do we certainly know that every bottle shall be filled with wine? Then thou shalt say unto them, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will fill all the inhabitants of this land, even the kings that sit upon David's throne, and the priests and the prophets, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, with drunkenness. And I will dash them one against another, just like these big crocks being jostled, like you load a bunch of them in the back of a wagon on a bumpy road, and they're smacking against each other. And what's going to happen? They're going to be dashed them against one another, and their fathers and their sons together, and I will not pity nor spare nor have mercy upon them. They're going to be broken as they smash against each other. And why? Because they're drunken. And not necessarily referring to actually alcoholic wine, but rather the fact that they can't function right. They're not thinking straight. And so the jar is destroyed or smashed together, verse 14. Warning against pride, verse 15. Hear ye and give ear. Be not proud, for the Lord hath spoken. Give glory to the Lord your God before he causes darkness and before your feet stumble upon the dark mountains, and look ye for light. Ye turn into the shadow of death. It shall be gross darkness. But if you will not hear, my soul shall weep in my secret places for your pride, and mine eyes shall weep sore and run down with tears, because the Lord's flock is carried away captive. He says, repent of your arrogance, because otherwise, while it's still light, because otherwise the darkness is going to come, and you have Jeremiah's grief over the
the circumstance, the darkness and sorrow that will follow their brief enlightenment. Verse 18, tragedy in the royal house. And again, a call for humility. Verse 18. Say unto the king and the queen, that would be the queen mother. Some of your new translations might have the word mother after that. Say unto the king and to the queen, humble yourselves, sit down for your, and you have the word principalities there. You have a word there that is very rare in Hebrew. They've translated the King James principalities. Who has a different translation? What do they have? What do you have there? What do you have? Rule. Pardon me? Rule. All right. What else? Beautiful crown. Now, all these things are related to each other. Principality is, in essence, an old-style synonym for your rule, your authority. The crown was the symbol of that authority. The king wore the crown. That was a symbol of his power, his authority. So, in order to get the theme that he's talking about here, imagine crown. They all convey the same idea, but if you think crown, it'll help you. Say unto the king and the queen, humble yourselves, sit down, and for your crowns shall come down, even the crown of your glory. The cities of the south shall be shut up, and none shall open them. Judah shall be carried away captive, all of it. It shall be wholly carried away captive. What he's doing is he's telling the royal family, humble yourselves now. Submit to God. Because your arrogance in being royalty, your crowns are going to be snatched away in short order by Nebuchadnezzar when he comes, and you're going to be trudging in sackcloth all the way back up to Babylon. So you better to humble yourself now rather than have it forced upon you when Nebuchadnezzar comes. Yeah, same idea. The reign, there's a bunch of different ways to convey that idea. Hebrew, much more so than English, deals with words that are more general. Not always, but there's more of that in Hebrew than you have in English. In part because English has got this massive vocabulary, and we have a very specific word for everything. You know, somebody comes up with something new, instead of just adding an adjective like the Germans do, we create a whole new word for it. And that's why English has three times the vocabulary of any other language. We just keep coming up with new words. Verse 20. Captivity and shame of Judah. Now, I dealt with a little bit ago dealing with the idea of diplomacy, juggling Egypt and Babylon, and getting all friendly with these people. Hey, you're my buddy. Yeah, that's right. You're my buddy. Don't hurt me. You're my buddy. That was the way that they operated. And so in verse 20, lift up your eyes and behold them that come from the north. That would be Babylon, coming from that direction, even though Babylon, you know, if you look at a big map, is just about due east. But they had to come from the north in order to get there. Lift up your eyes, behold them that come from the north. Where is the flock that I have given thee, thy beautiful flock? What wilt thou say when he shall punish thee? For thou hast taught them to be captains and as a chief over thee. Shall not sorrows take thee as a woman in travail? You have submitted yourself to them. You have catered to them, to their leadership. You have submitted to them in covenant. Hey, we'll go ahead and sign this covenant and you'll look after us. Which is how it worked. But instead, they're not gonna get the positive, they're gonna get the negative of it. The allies become their taskmasters. And why was that to be the case? Verse 22, if thou say in thine heart, why has this happened? Why has this come upon me? For the greatness, and this, he uses blatant illustrations here, very, very kind of coarse illustrations here in the end here. He says, for the greatness of thine iniquity are thy skirts discovered and thy heels made bare. Barefoot. And when it talks about your skirts revealed, they would make the people on some of these things, especially if they were as a punishment and as a humiliation to the people. They would pull. Now remember, they didn't have underwear like we do today. They would pull the skirt up and over their head, and they would have to walk that way to Babylon. being exposed from here down. Their head's covered, so they're protected from the sun there, but the humiliation of that. And that was one of the punishments also for a prostitute. And the idea of the heels bare means they're going to be barefoot going. He says in verse 23, can the Ethiopian change his skin? Can a leopard change his spots? And if they can, then may ye do also good that are accustomed to do evil. He says, you folks are so corrupt, you can't change. An Ethiopian can't change his skin, a leopard can't change his spots, and you can't change from doing your wickedness. Therefore, I will scatter thee as the stubble that passes away by the wind in the wilderness, the chaff that is blown away by the desert winds. That's what I'm going to do to you. This is thy lot, the portion of thy measure from me, saith the Lord. Because thou hast forgotten me and trusted in falsehood, their idolatry, therefore I will discover thy skirts upon thy face, what he alluded to earlier, that thy shame may appear. I have seen thine adulteries and thy nayings and the lewdness of thy whoredom and thy abominations on the hills, in the fields. Woe unto thee, O Jerusalem, wilt thou not be made clean? When shall it once be? When are you folks going to get your act together? And of course, as we get through this, it doesn't happen until after the captivity. It doesn't happen until they're carried away. They will not learn the lesson. You have Jeremiah preaching to them, begging, pleading with them, giving them all kinds of illustrations. And every time he says it's going to happen, Jeremiah's word always comes to pass. He says Nebuchadnezzar's going to come and he's going to carry away this king, because you had a succession of kings. You had Josiah. You had Jehoiakim. You had Jehoiakim. And then you had Zedekiah. And this guy, all three of these guys got carried away captive in succession about 10 years apart. And Jeremiah says it's going to happen. Nebuchadnezzar's going to come. False prophets here. Nah, Nebuchadnezzar's not going to come. Nebuchadnezzar came. He came. Well, he's not going to come back, and the stuff he carried away is going to come back. He comes and takes this guy away. Well, he's going to come back, and the goods that Nebuchadnezzar took away are going to come back. And then he comes and gets this guy and destroys everything and carries the balance away. He told them. It came to pass. Do they pay any attention? And then we get into the passages later on in the book that the people who were left, that were left in the land after Nebuchadnezzar carried them all away captive and destroyed Jerusalem, still wouldn't listen to Jeremiah. If anybody felt like banging their head against the wall, it was Jeremiah. And you can imagine how God is. You know, of course, God knows the end from the beginning. But you can imagine God's frustration, if you could say God gets frustrated, with this people who have had more privilege and more opportunity as far as God's revelation to them. And they don't pay attention. Just like Christendom in the Western world. We talked about this morning. They've got this. They can read it. It says what it says. That isn't what it means. It means something else. But that's what it says. Yeah, but it means something else. We have a better idea. And we're no different. We're no better. Yeah. You had a small remnant at the time of Jeremiah. You got a small remnant today. And guess what? Throughout history, it's always been a small remnant. It's no different today than it was, frankly, 100 years ago when we were having all these revivals breaking out. You may have had a little bit higher percentage and a little more public acceptance. But as far as the real numbers, I don't think things have changed drastically in the Western world. Has densities in different places, but I don't think it's changed drastically in the Western world in the last 200 years. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. May we be faithful. May we not look down our noses at those who reject the truth. Father, may we, as Jeremiah, weep and pray for them and declare to them the truth. Father, our obligation is to speak the truth. Their obligation is to believe. We cannot change hearts. Father, we are simply the messengers of your word, and I pray that you'd help us to be faithful in doing so. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.